they're real.
Wow, it's like, you know, doesn't mean we'll have to share it, but you just, I just had too many experiences of, and if people say they don't want to record it, that's absolutely fine too. But often I'll say, well, I don't know if we should record it. Okay, I won't. And then it's like, oh, I wish we recorded it. So you don't get a second chance for that. You can always delete it. So
yeah, that's cool.
Well, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Well, my name is Gabrielle. I'm French speaking, so you hear my accent. I live in Trois-Rivières, Quebec. So yeah, and I'm a mom of a 2-year-old, a little girl. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we just learned yesterday that we're expecting another one.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank
Wonderful.
You. Yeah, it's really nice. We're so happy.
Oh, terrific. Yeah. Terrific.
And I'm also a PhD student in the here in the University of Trois-Rivières.
Wow. As if you weren't busy enough.
Yeah. I like to be busy. The more I carry, the better I go.
I can understand that.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I study end of life, like anything that that's related to end of life. So medical aid and dying, palliative care. And yeah, that's about it for,
Interesting.
Yeah.
How did you get interested in that?
Well, it kind of went a weird way at first because I'm from Aylmer, actually. It's a small city, maybe 15 minutes from Ottawa. And it's on the Quebec side. And when I was a teenager, I really wanted to be a midwife. So I moved to Trois-Rivières because it's the only university in Quebec that offers the bachelor in midwifery. And I tried to enter the program, but I was refused. So I went to psychology, a bachelor in psychology.
Okay.
And from there, I've had like a beautiful lecture on end of life from a teacher that really like connected to who I felt like who I felt I really was.
Yeah.
So, and I just started volunteering in palliative care, like really close to my house. So yeah, this was a kind of a beautiful experience. I was a volunteer there for about 5 or 6 years, like from 2011 from till maybe 2017.
Okay.
Yeah. So it made me like, it made me connect even more with my spiritual like side of myself, but I wasn't religious at that point. So yeah.
Well, end of life issues will do that.
Yeah.
They really will. I think part of the secularity of our culture is because so much end of life stuff is sort of avoided and removed and sort of encapsulated and put away.
Yeah. People don't have any experience of like a close one dying until they're like 50 or 60 when their parents die.
Yeah.
And even at that moment, they don't usually like care for the dying. They just like let it be done by someone else, by a professional. So they don't really have like a profound connection with what dying is.
Right.
And like, from experience and what I like to say to people who's people get curious why like a young 20 something year old would go and volunteer in a hospice. But like, I truly heard laughing and like happy times more often than crying in a palliative care house, which is kind of surprising. Like it's not the common idea that people get at first, you know.
No.
It's usually like a really blessed moment that you get to share with your loved one, and you don't get any other moment in your life that's that intense and that powerful. That's true.
And as a pastor, I see that often as well. People I'll surprise people when I'll say I often prefer doing funerals to weddings, and they'll be like, you know, the weddings are joyful events. Well, funerals, they're not funerals aren't happy, but they sometimes are joyful. And even I just recently did a funeral for a young woman who she was just going to turn 40, and she died in a car accident and left 2 sons. And so a tragic funeral, but there's a community and a seriousness and a meaningfulness if people are coming together in a good way, that you're exactly right. You don't often experience, there's people have very little experience of that, because everything, like you say, care of the aged and dying is outsourced to medical professionals often.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been with people who've died at home, and I've been with people who've died at the hospital. You're much better off dying at home.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not close.
You can't compare them. No, you can't.
Hospitals now, one of my friends, when he died, the hospitals are sort of accommodating to this. They'll sometimes have rooms. There'll be mm-hmm. single rooms on a quiet floor of the hospital, and they'll give a little bit of ask. And that's good, because sometimes it is appropriate to, you know, to have an added level of palliative care, which you can afford in a hospital, which it's difficult to do at home. But you're right.
Mm-hmm. And the sad thing, like, you know, well, you're in California, right?
Yeah.
So you have made in California.
What's that?
You have medical aid in dying in California? You do?
I don't know, like, what they call it that. We have hospice.
it's euthanasia or assisted suicide. No, I thought you had assisted suicide.
Oregon has it. And California, I'm not sure. I haven't experienced it, but that's partly the sample that I'm going to have in terms of mostly working at that point with Christians.
Yeah, for sure.
I haven't yet been embroiled in a family fight, but once you have medical assisted suicide, this is the terminology they use here, I expect there will be conflict, partly because I've seen it. I ran a grief group for a couple of years, and one of the women, it was open to the public. So one of the women came in, and she was angry because she believed that her stepfather basically neglected her mother into death, you know, and people don't talk about these things much, but mm-hmm. they're not that uncommon.
Yeah. They're very common, actually.
Yeah.
Like homicidal attitudes or suicidal attitudes are really common in family caregivers.
Yeah.
Way more than we think.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I understand that. You watch a lot of people die, and you see people suffer, and you know, even without, again, medical assisted suicide, many people die because they reach a stage and the hospital and the caregivers just really push the morphine.
Yeah, it's called the double effect.
Oh,
it may happen, but it's not as common as we think, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
People usually die because they die of thirst or hunger at that point, or their cancer is just out of control. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
So I don't know if you intended to talk about this today, but
I always talk about this.
Oh, you must be fun at parties.
Yeah,
oh, here's the woman that talks about dying.
But I'm a fun girl, so it passes. Okay. We'll love to talk about death, though.
I've already grabbed 10 minutes of your time. I don't know if you wanted to go more into your story, or if you wanted some other things that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, well, maybe I can go with my Jordan Peterson experience.
Okay.
As everyone goes.
Yep.
So it's my story of conversion, actually. So I'm Catholic now. I've been practicing for like 3 years. Well, I converted in 2018. Yeah. And so it's basically the same story as everyone on Bridges of Meaning. Yeah. Well, he's a ladder, you know, he shows us the way, and then we do the rest of the path by ourselves. Yeah. So yeah, I was just like a very spiritually inclined person, and like all those existential questions were really like in my mind all the time. So it wasn't really hard to grasp, to catch it, you know, to catch the fever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, and then it was so funny because like I remember that one time talking about synchronicity, but like my boyfriend and I, we were in the living room on our cell phones and we were both on like reading a different article on Jordan Peterson for the first time at the same time, like exactly at the same time. And then like I got out of my phone, I was like, do you know Jordan Peterson? He was like, why do you say that? And I was like, yeah, well, I'm reading about him. But it was the article I was reading was like a really harsh critique on him, like a woke critique. Yeah. And he was reading something more like compassionate and understanding of his ways. So that opened the door. It was really at the same time. It was so fun. So I just started to listen to his videos and then podcasts. And what really did the work was the biblical series, of course. Yeah. But like I studied psychology for 5 years and I was working with the dying and I was like really, really into like, I was seeing myself being like a palliative care worker, researcher or something in that field. So when I had like what I needed to get the symbolic language going, like I didn't have it at first because I didn't grow up in a religious household. We're in Quebec, nobody's religious. Nobody's religious. It's crazy. It was the most religious place in the world at once.
Yes.
But now nobody's religious. It's absolutely insane.
Yeah, Peugeot said very interesting, similar things. And yeah. That fascinates me how, you know, what must have prompted that transformation in Quebec? Because it was one of the most religious places in the world. And then
of course it was.
Whoosh, it's gone.
In the 60s, like my parents were our typical baby boomers. They grew up like in religious households. They went to church, they did everything really, really Catholic. And then in the 60s, they just left religion aside, but they still kept like all the premises and all the moral, you know, it's all there. They never gave it away. It's just all there.
Yeah.
Like they called it, my father used to say, well, he says, he doesn't say God, he say like the super mega computer. Well, I like it. He's a believer. He just like, he believes like he wants.
yeah.
So yeah, I grew up in that kind of household, but like really like still like respectful of Christianity, but like in a really Quebecois sauce.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy. In Trois-Rivières, it's like, it's maybe 135,000 population.
Uh-huh.
Not, it's kind of a big city for Quebec. And we have like, I think 16 mega churches, like they're huge. Maybe not mega churches as you think of it, but like really, really big churches for a small city. And we have maybe like eight monasteries and it's really, really big. And they're all being sold for peanuts.
Wow.
Yeah. Like there's a church, I live in a parish called Saint-Sacrement. It's Sacramento.
Yeah.
And they just sold the church like on the other side of the road and they sold it for $250,000. And it's huge. It's a big church. I did the calculation like in dollars from 1956 and it was $6 million to build. So, and like just last fall, they sold 5 of the 11 churches that we have in Trois-Rivières. And there are other churches like surrounding Trois-Rivières, like a basilica and a cathedral and everything. But like, it's going at such a rapid rate, and they're bulldozing them. They're selling them to condos, and it's really, really saddening. I'm laughing, but it's saddening.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and they're beautiful churches, you know, like
I'm sure they
Catholic
are.
Churches. They're like. Yeah. Exuberant and they're like they're very well built and like the art is magnificent, you know.
They were built imagining that these things would be used for hundreds of years.
Yeah, they were, and they were used for 50 years and that's that.
Is anybody studying this or writing about this?
Well, it's such a huge issue that it's like contentious with the government and with the like the parishes. So I don't know how you can really like dive into this without like being hurt. I don't know. It's like, it's such a huge issue. And like nobody wants them. Like there's one church, Saint Cecile, it turned into a trampoline thing, you know, like it's just, nobody wants those churches. They're gonna die for sure very soon. Maybe the cathedral and the basilica and that's it.
I mean, the question of the buildings is the symptom of, you know, the underlying story in terms of what happened to the people and the culture.
Yeah.
That's because, you know, my denomination, the Christian Reformed Church, is a binational denomination. And right now there's a fair amount of anxiety between the U.S. and the Canadian. There's some tensions in the binationality of the Christian Reformed Church right now. But the takeaway was always Canada is a far more secular, unchurched country than the United States.
Yeah, and that's right for Canada, but not for Quebec.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I had always assumed that Quebec would have sort of been an exception to that. But, well, it's interesting, too, because, you know, within Peugeot's story, I mean, his parents were raised Roman Catholic and, you know, converted to evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they saw what was going on, what happened in, I don't want to derail your conversation. I mean, the problem is you put all these interesting things
culture,
in front of me.
So that's nice. I'm glad to share my culture with you. It's not, you don't have a lot of Quebec representatives.
what happened to the church in Quebec? Did they just sort of capitulate? I mean, didn't they fight for their people? I mean, what happened in the 60s?
I wouldn't know how to start. It's like the big cultural movement that just like swept really hard in Quebec. And like, I think it was maybe just like the return of the pendulum, because it was so hard to be Catholic in those days. It was really, really like, it was really demanding to be Catholic in Quebec. It was a particular branch of Roman Catholicism. It's called Ultramontanism.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like probably the most hardcore one.
Yeah.
So like, I remember like my grandmother was like always popping children because it was the thing to do with like the priest was like going to houses and almost forcing women to have children. And it was really like, it was a hard time. And I think like all those grievances are like, should have been heard. But I think like, the church probably made the error to go too far in the pendulum after that, because they saw, they heard the criticism of being like too intense, and they probably went too Jesus pop, you know.
Yeah.
Too easy on the people. So like it's not good either way. So yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's
interesting.
But like it's really weird to be like a young Catholic, a young convert Catholic here in Quebec, because like I'm absolutely sure it would be easier to come out as transgender or anything else than Catholic here, for sure. It's so weird.
Oh, you'd be celebrated. You're a pioneer. You're so brave. Yeah, for sure. It's like, oh, I don't think that's brave. The whole culture is basically celebrating that bravery is being countercultural.
Yeah. But it's insane. It's upside down, really.
Anyway, I've distracted you again. No, so you and your boyfriend were simultaneously reading Jordan Peterson articles, and then you saw the biblical series, and you had to, you know, you needed to get symbolic language going. What was it like going to church for the first time?
I remember before going to church for the first time, like I was in the kitchen with my boyfriend. I was like realizing that I was envious of that joy Christians had. And I told him that, like, literally, like, I want that joy. So I just went to church the next Sunday. And I was in church for the first time and like really, really in church, because I went to church from time to time, just for fun, just because I like being in the cathedral and it's beautiful, but I never like went to church like consciously. And I was weeping in church, like it was overwhelming. And I remember a woman that came to me after that, and she was like, there's so much love in here. Like, do you see it now? That was it. That was the moment of my conversion.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was really powerful. And I just continued going from there.
So did you have to go through a process of catechesis, or had you been baptized as a child?
I was baptized, because okay. Everyone's baptized in my generation.
Okay.
Like, not the new, like, everyone's baptized till 2000. Like, all the millennials are baptized.
Interesting.
Yeah, we're all baptized. But we seldom have, like, our first communion, or confirmation is really, really rare. But, like, that was the nice thing, because I had my first communion, so I could have the Holy Host.
You didn't have to wait and go through a process before wait. You could participate.
Yeah, but I didn't do my confirmation. So I still had that I could do, which was awesome, because I could do it with, like, intent, you know?
Yes.
And it was a beautiful celebration. Like, yeah, awesome.
What did you do classes? Did you meet with the priest? I mean, what did
we that had look like that's so weird. It speaks of our culture. Because we were supposed to have, like, I think two or three classes with, like, a group. Yeah. And it boiled down to one morning, about 2 hours. Huh. And we were, like, about 30 young adults in the room. And I was the only one doing it because I had faith. Like, all the other ones were doing it because they wanted to get married, or because they wanted to become godparents.
Wow.
Yeah. So, like, there may be a way to, like, hook these people, you know, because I'm pretty sure, like, if we could use that symbolic language, like, leaning into that with them,
yeah,
it could really work. I'm sure of that, you know. But, like, the priest has no idea of symbolic language and, like, how to relate, like, their, like, how to put the two blocks together, you know, like, the religious and, like, the secular. They don't know how to do it. So those people were just there to, like, pass the time and go to their confirmation afterwards.
Now, I know with the Catholic Church, to be married by the Church, you do have to go through a process. I mean, they're quite serious about that here, even in the States too. So you're saying a lot of the people in that class, they wanted to get married, and, you know, because there's still culturally some value about getting married in a beautiful building with a religious mm-hmm. ceremony. And I imagine that's still in the culture for a number of people.
Yeah, it is.
Wow. So,
but I don't know about the marriage process yet. One day I'll know.
So are you married?
Not yet, no.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you've got some work to do yet.
Yeah. Well, it's not on my part, actually. Well, I really want to, and my boyfriend too, but he's just like, he hasn't had the same, like, awakening to faith as I have.
Okay.
He's really respectful of it. Like, really, it's surprising how respectful he is and how encouraging he is. And he comes to Mass, like, on Christmas and on Easter, and, like, he does the sign of the cross and all, but, like, he says he's a practicing non-believing.
Okay.
So I think, like, I always, like, think that it's like, faith is a gift from God. So that's all I can pray for, is that God gives him the gift to faith. And
you can do what you can, but God gives the gift.
Yeah, that's right. And, like, another thing is that marriage is really uncommon in Quebec too, you know, like, it's absolutely not the same as in Canada or the US. We're the champion of having babies and not being married. So, like, it's not an uncommon thing. Like, marriage is uncommon. I'd say, like, maybe, I don't know, 70% of couples are not married, at least. Maybe even more.
I am so, you've just really piqued my interest in what on earth has happened in Quebec.
You should come visit. It's beautiful.
I visited Quebec once when I was a boy. My parents, we'd like to go on these camping vacations, and my father always wanted to go to these different places. My mother was usually a little more reluctant. So we visited the St. Lawrence Seaway. I remember that. Cool. And we were in Montreal, And I remember there was like an amusement park or something, and there was a line. There was a line for a ride, and I was in line, and there were a couple other kids, and they were speaking French, and I didn't speak any French. All I remember is that they were mean to me. That's all I remember from Quebec. Is that I remember camping by the St. Lawrence Seaway and hearing those ships go by, and I remember those kids in the line were mean to me, and I, you know, wouldn't speak in the same language literally. So I
Montreal is really English, so you wouldn't have any problem. But
well,
the rest of Quebec is French.
I would go to Quebec with a much different attitude these days as an adult, but it's my only memory of Quebec. I would love to go. I'll have to, you know, I'm really trying to talk my wife into wanting to do, you know, an estuary tour with me, and she's you know, I got her out to Australia. And so I'm thinking maybe Europe 2022, I'm thinking about that, but Quebec is definitely on the list, but I'll probably get Peugeot here to Sacramento first. Cause it's,
yeah, for sure. Well, I think we can travel to the US, but you can't travel to Canada for now.
I just heard it opened.
Oh yeah, really?
Yeah. And so I'm actually planning my vacation. I'll be going up to Glacier National Park. And now that I heard it's open, I'm thinking, I'm going to take my passport and my vax card and see if I can get into Banff. So I don't know. We'll see.
Never went to the West Coast.
Really?
Well, it's so far.
That's true. Where people live in Canada, it's like the strip all along the southern border.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a big area.
Quebec is huge. It's like, I think, 6 or 8 times the size of France. But like we just live near the St. Lawrence River. That's it.
Yeah. No, I definitely want to get to Quebec. I'm so frustrated that I don't know more languages.
Yeah.
I mean, the time to learn languages is when you're young.
Yeah.
And we should be teaching kids languages like crazy. And here in the United States, they just simply don't do it.
Yeah. Don't you speak Spanish?
I do speak Spanish.
Yeah. That's cool.
But I worked in Spanish. But if I had known French, I could have had an easier time, you know, learning more Creole with the Haitians I worked with. So I would love to know German, English, Spanish, French. You know, I wish my Greek were better. I wish my Hebrew were better.
That's useful.
Arabic would be good. I'm gonna be 58. It's brain plasticity's gone.
Yeah, it's hard.
Anyway, I have hijacked the conversation again. You just have too many interesting topics.
Yeah, and about Peugeot, like just an aparté, but like I don't know if you heard, but he did his first interview in French like a month ago.
No.
His first interview in French. It blew my mind. Like a friend of mine told me, like he doesn't even follow Jonathan Peugeot when he saw the podcast. It's like when I put it on the TV, because the podcast is a new podcast by a famous rapper here in Quebec, and like when I put it on the TV, I just like started to sob.
he definitely needs to do more in French for Quebec, given everything you've told me.
It's insane.
He's needed by your people.
Absolutely. Like I was like, I just, when I started the podcast, I just realized how much we needed the cultural connection with him. Cause he speaks to you guys. He speaks to Canadians and to Americans. So he doesn't speak of our culture. He doesn't give us tools to understand what happened in our culture. He gives you tools, but he doesn't give us tools. So we have to like transpose the tools that he uses for you to help you understand what happens, and then and bring them back here and try to like mix match something, you know.
I'm gonna have to talk to him about this. Yeah, I guess so, Jonathan, sure. We appreciate your generosity to the English language world, but you need to up the priority to your own people.
Yeah, but like no one's a prophet on their land. I think
that's true too. That's true.
And like I get it. And I feel like maybe he's scared, like of what would happen here, because like people can like pillory him. I don't know. Yeah. Like it can be harsh here, you know. And there's like I think like there's maybe like a few hundred people around here and there in Montreal and like maybe other cities, but there's not like a big population of people who can gather and listen to him, you know. But I think it's, that doesn't really matter. It's just like if he speaks and like he can, like he was so eloquent in French, like speaking about our culture and like he spoke of Kanye and like of BLM and everything, and like how it made sense to Montrealers, and like I'm sure it helped like so many people just to like understand what happened like in their own lives because it was in French, just because of the language. It was like really like reassuring that we were part of the conversation, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm reading a book written by one of my old college profs, Dalvin Clay, who wrote on the religious roots of the French Revolution. And I haven't gotten too far in the book. I'm still in contact with him, but I do, you know, cause Montreal's hit, you know, the French Canadian history is so interesting because of course the French were there, but then in the, it's either the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, as it's known in the US, of course the French lost, mm-hmm. and they traded Canada for Martinique, mm-hmm. and it's like, I don't know how good that deal looks now.
They have sugar.
Right, they had sugar. So for France, it was like, well, Saint-Domingue, which was, you know, the Haitian side of the island, was, you know, the most productive colony that France had. The Caribbean with sugar, mm-hmm. was seen as that, those were the jewels in their crown. Mm-hmm. And of course, Saint-Domingue and everything that happened. Of course, the Spanish were on the other side. And so I know some of the history of Hispaniola because I was there. But it's the you know, I really want to get into this book by my professor because the history. Gosh, this is probably better for a monologue video than to take your time with it because we only have an hour. So I'll shut up again. But what happened in Christianity with the French people on both sides of the Atlantic is fascinating because there's a, you know, I know from Dutch culture, immigrant cultures are interesting because they preserve something of the time period that they left.
Yeah, that's right. Our accent.
Yeah. Well, the accent.
French, yeah.
But also, so the, in the Christian Reformed Church, those who came over from the Netherlands and founded the Christian Reformed Church in North America, they very much first preserved the Afskeiding, which was sort of a religious movement out of the state church in the 1830s. And then then later on, at the end of the 19th century, Abraham Kuyper, the Doleancy, that movement, those movements got preserved in the immigrants and held on to, even though things continued to move on in the Netherlands. And so an immigrant culture preserves something of the time they left. And that's partly because immigrants, the shock of the relocation means you hold on to certain things tighter that they're not necessarily holding on to in their land. Yeah, and so yeah. The continued deeply, I'm just gonna, now you've just provoked me. I want to look into French Canadian history because
you should.
I'm sure it's a very interesting story.
We weren't as Catholic as we were in the 20th century, like when we first arrived in Quebec. It came after the rebellions in 1836, 1837, where like we had an elite that was put down by the Canadian government because we had like rebellions to form a country.
Right, right. Quebec.
So like the elite was just, they were all hung. So like because the elite was decimated, we had to like to build a new elite. So then came in the clergy around that time. So like the really, really Christian phase of Quebec is between the rebellions of 1837 until the 1960s. So it's about a little more than 100 years.
That's interesting.
But we were Catholics, but we weren't as Catholics as we were at that moment.
Well, that's what happens often with, let's say, you know, so immigrants that came to the United States from the Netherlands became more religious when they got to the United States, partly because they were resisting a broader, you know, Anglophone culture that they wanted to maintain their for Dutch sure. identity.
That's the same thing here.
And yeah. so the religion is a good way to sort yeah, of for sure. maintain it.
We're like Canada's built on two races. It's the like Catholics and the Protestants.
Yeah.
sorry.
No.
Tonic accent is not at the same place in French, so sometimes it's confusing.
sure.
So yeah. So but we were called races. You know, like we were blacks and whites. You know, because we were of different. Ethnical backgrounds.
You were of different roots.
Yeah, for sure.
That's, you know, race comes from roots.
For sure.
Raíces and Spanish. Like,
it was like a matter of like Catholics versus Protestants until the church decimated, like until the church went away in Quebec, and then it became French and English. But it wasn't about French and English before that moment. Like the civil moment, like the Quebec really was invented after the church was gone. It was French-Canadian before we were French-Canadian, and we had like a commonwealth with all the French-Canadian in Canada as well. It wasn't only in Quebec. And then because of, like, the church disappeared, we had to like build a new cultural identity, and it's now built on French. But like that too is fickle, you know, it's a good foundation. Yes, of course, we share French and we don't share it with the English, but like still it doesn't give us a goal. God used to give us a goal, you know.
Yeah.
But French does not. So it's different.
So interesting.
Yeah. And we have this kind of a thing here in my household because my boyfriend and I are really like separatist. We are in the Parti Québécois. It's a separatist party in Quebec. Usually, like, the elections in Quebec are like in between the Liberal Party and the Parti Québécois. That's the traditional like balance of things. Like, you can see the Liberal Party in Quebec as being the conservative party and the Parti Québécois as being the progressive party.
That's so interesting.
But like, when we say conservative, it's like right. super progressive for you guys.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, really.
They're inverted.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. So yeah. So like we have that tension in our house too, because my boyfriend and I, we work for the PQ, and we do things for them, and we really believe in sovereignty. But at the same time, I'm Christian, so like I have to like do some kind of a math, you know, like which God do I put first in the equation?
Because
like Quebec has a principality.
Yes.
So it's an angel. We can put it at top of the hierarchy, but we don't have to. We can put God too, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of a struggle sometimes. But I think we did the same thing as a culture, you know, like we switched principalities at some point. Wait, we switched God for a principality. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, this is so interesting. Oh, it's so bad when I find interesting things because it's like, I want to learn more. I don't have time. I want to learn more. I'm already reading too many books right now. Now I want to go out and look for a book on French Canadian history because it makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting what happened to. I mean, the dynamics of politics and religion between church and state are, I mean, in the United States, I mean, it was just kind of the First Amendment sort of draws this line and says, okay, here's mm-hmm. the line. But you have to draw the line because otherwise
we did last year. Last year we had a law passed, laïcité. How do we say it? Like to make a divide between the church and the state, you know, like what's laicity?
Yeah.
Laicity law that was passed last year in Quebec, and like because like the thing is like it was just a law to make sure that people in a position of authority wouldn't wear religious symbols. That's it. That's the law. That's the extent of it. But it was like, it was considered homo, like xenophobic and racist and everything by the rest of Canada. It's insane. So yeah, because we don't have the same vision of living together with immigrants, and like we prefer a more intercultural attitude opposed to a multicultural attitude that Canada has. So like, it was not very well received, but I'm not that versed in politics. So maybe it's not the best subject for me now. Even in English, it's harder.
but it's so interesting because, I mean, the French vision of secularity, and this is very well known, is quite distinct from the American vision of secularity. Because in France, of course, had laws against the hijab, laws against various Islamic symbols in public. Whereas in the United States, you have laws protecting the use of those religious symbols. And those were in some ways strained, partly because when the Republicans were putting up some conservative Roman Catholics to the Supreme Court, and they were getting difficulty from the Democrats. And, you know, some people saying, hey, wait a minute, in the U.S. Constitution specifically prohibits a religious test for, you know, qualification for participation in the government. So, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And like at the same time, because like this law was considered like racist against Muslims.
Sure.
Because it was kind of targeting them at some point, because it made like the victim in that story was that teachers couldn't wear hijabs anymore. So they were the victim in that story, but like they aren't the victim, you know?
Well, and it's so fascinating that your prime minister has the last name of Trudeau, and he's such a multiculturalist, it appears.
Yeah, but that's not his law. That's Legault's law.
Oh.
Trudeau is multiculturalist. So he vehemently opposes this law. This is only a law in Quebec. So the rest of Canada is really mad at this law because it absolutely opposes their multiculturalist view.
Boy, yeah. Is that interesting?
Yeah. So we had like, so the thing is, because like they wanted to make to make sure that it wasn't a racist law.
Yeah.
They took out the cross at the parliament in Quebec. There was the cross in the middle of the house. It's not the House of Commons, but it's a, yeah, the parliament.
Yeah.
they took it out and they put it in a box in the hall so everyone could see the cross. But like now it's out of the parliament. And that was a big moment for me, I think. It was kind of, a sad moment, I think. Because it was useful, that cross, you know?
This is so interesting. Yeah. This is so interesting. Wow. You know, I sort of quipped in a few videos where, and in fact, in a sermon that, you know, I think it's more likely we'll see Canada break up before we see the United States. But talking to you doesn't, you know, turn me from that opinion either, because the tensions, I mean, there've always been tensions between Quebec and the rest of the country, sure. But those tensions run deep, and all of the where all of the cultural energy is going now is going to exacerbate those tensions.
Yeah. But at the same time, the separatist movement has never been that low. So
interesting.
It's very weird. So people are really nationalist. Like they really believe, like if you ask any Quebecer if they're Canadian or Quebecer, they'll say they're Quebecers. Like it's almost an insult if you go see a Quebecer and tell them they're Canadian, even if they're not separatists. It's just our identity is not Canadian, you know. But still, like they're very proud of being Quebecers, but they're in the status quo. You know, it's not that bad of a situation. We can get our cake and eat it too. You know, it's still fine. You know, it's just like there are really deep rooted tensions that will always be there. But at the same time, I think that maybe it's just a matter of we have an enemy. Like we will always have an enemy because we're part of Canada. So that's kind of a good thing for a group.
Yep. No, that's right. That's what yeah. really fuels and energizes yeah. a group. Is nothing will push them together like an enemy.
Yeah. So sometimes you want to keep an enemy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we got about, you know, we have about 10 minutes left. So I feel bad because you had this all this time and here I blew it on all my questions because you had such interesting things. So no, what did you want to talk about? It's fun to share about my,
well, I wanted to talk about faith and end of life actually. Cause like we, in 2015, we had a new law passed in Quebec for like legalizing euthanasia. And that was a like fast move from the Quebec government because it wasn't legal in Canada yet. So usually like it's a matter of like levels of like criminal justice. So like you can't change criminal justice with provincial laws. It's federal. But like the Quebec government passed a law that making euthanasia a healthcare, it's a care now. So they could do it because it wasn't considered as a criminal act. It was in the healthcare system. And then after that, the Canadian government passed the bill so they can legalize euthanasia and assisted suicide as well. Wow. But that's a hard one because like there's a lot of cases in Quebec of euthanasia. We don't have assisted suicide in Quebec. We only have a euthanasia. So it's the doctor that gives the medication to kill the patient. It's not the, like in Oregon, they have assisted suicide. So they give a prescription so the person could get the pills to kill themselves whenever they feel to. And oftentimes about 40% of the times they don't do it. which tells a lot.
Well, it's one thing to think about it in the abstract. It's another thing to do it.
Absolutely. But like 100% of euthanasia demands that are accepted are done. That's not the same thing.
No, that isn't the same thing.
Yeah. It's kind of scary if you think of it because like there probably was the same amount of people who were hesitant and couldn't express their hesitation because as soon as you say it, you're not really wanting it. So
yeah,
that's intense.
That is, I'd never thought about the distinction and the difference in how that's rolled out, but that makes a world of sense.
Yeah.
And again, and it just to tie it into the secularism conversation, in many ways, it's astounding that Quebec would be ahead of Canada on something like euthanasia. That's again, talk about the whiplash of, you know, to go from, you know, because in the United States, the Roman Catholic Church, at least the conservative church, they are the vanguard of anti-abortion, of euthanasia. You know, all of these things are, you know, the conservative Catholics, they are, I mean, evangelicals get all the press, but the conservative Catholics, they are the vanguard on this stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
And so then in Quebec, to just have it swing the other way.
And it's like, it was celebrated, you know? Like, the thing is, that was part of my conversion, actually, because I always felt I was against euthanasia because I worked in a palliative care center. So I knew what palliative care was and how it really relieved people, you know, like it really works.
Yeah.
And people have good times. Like of course they're dying. Of course they're suffering, but like at least they're not that suffering because they have medication and they have like a whole crew of medical staff that knows what they do and they have the people they love around them and they can have like a really high quality time that they would never have otherwise.
Yes.
And like it baffles me. Like I knew that and I knew the Catholic Church was against euthanasia. So for me it was like, okay, so then I must have something in common with the Catholic Church more than just my attitudes toward euthanasia. Cause like I felt the same moral groundings, you know, like I felt like it for the same reasons I believe it's not okay to take the life of someone at the end of their life. I feel, I believe they're the same reasons in the Catholic Church. So I thought maybe there's more to know about the Catholic Church. Maybe there's there's more common sense than we think, you know?
Yeah.
So that was like a part of my conversion too, because I was like, this is too close not to be true. Like, this is my natural attitudes toward this matter and the position of the Catholic Church are too close not for me to find some other truths, you know, on other things in life.
Yeah, no, Catholic makes Church. Sense.
Yeah.
That is, it's such an interesting, you know, all the pieces of this do fit together. And, you know, it is true that people, because dying has been so, I would imagine that in past generations, children, being a part of someone's death would be a part of a normal childhood process of growing up.
Absolutely.
And of course it can go badly. I mean, obviously losing a parent when you're a young child, something like that is going to be very traumatic for a child. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. But as you know, as we started, there is something to dying well. And see, this is what's so difficult. In that, you know, this is part of what I'm. So I just released a video on psychedelics today, and part of my resistance to that is, you know, Peterson, you know, quotes Jung in terms of unearned wisdom, mm-hmm. and I look at, in some ways, I look at euthanasia in a similar light to I look at conversion via psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically blunt forcing a particular experience through chemicals. Not all of our experiences are, of course, chemicals, but there's a pace to it.
Yeah, that's true.
And there's a context to it.
And there's the time too.
Yes.
There's like, you probably know the difference between Chronos and Kairos.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and that's the thing in the end of life, is that Chronos gets out of the door. It's not there anymore. And you can feel it as soon as you get in the hospice, like in the palliative care house.
Yeah.
It's just, you see, and I read that Chronos is the god of opportunity. So
interesting.
Yeah, and it's awesome because that's really how you feel. Like the end, like the dying process of someone is the last opportunity to bond with like their existential force. And it's fickle, and it's probably just a tiny moment for some, and it's just, but if you put a date in an hour, this is gone.
Yeah.
Chronos is there. There's no Kairos anymore.
Right. Kairos is opportunity.
Chronos. That's it. Yeah.
And no, like, that's right. That's right. But part of it, and this is something, again, having spent most of my ministry here in Sacramento with older people, you very much see that if you want to have the last years of your life, and I can tell it as I age, you know, when you're young, your body's working right, you know, you don't give a care to it. Now, as you get older, it's like, I got to pay more attention to diet and exercise. I have to pay, you know, I have to go to the seat of the doctor, you know, now suddenly, and this just heightens as you get older.
Yeah.
And in some ways, if you are doing your work, if you're doing your spiritual work, your formative work, you need that training for those last years of your life.
Absolutely. Yeah. You need the cross, actually.
Yeah, you do. You do.
Yeah.
You do. And then you also need to be building into the people around you the traditions, because as an older person, you're going to have to teach the younger people not only how to live well into later years, which is a lot more than denial, which tends to be the American way, but also you're going to have to teach the next generation how to die.
Yes, that's right. That's what I always say. We don't die for ourselves, we die for others.
Yes.
And like, if you only see people dying of euthanasia around you, what do you think will be your choice?
Yeah.
We're making the bed for that. We're making the bed for like mass euthanasia at some point. And like, we're opening the vans too, you know, like we're talking about opening it for Alzheimer's, for mature minors, and for people who only suffers from mental illness. That'll be really, really soon, like the next few years. So I don't know
what's happening. Well, I could, you know, the part of what I fear is that, you know, I'd spend a lot of time with people who are older than myself. They have mental illness, they have drug addiction. I could very easily see, once the country gets fed up enough with this population to, well, this is the merciful thing to do, because the indignity of, and I talk about that a fair amount on Twitter, the indignity of their homelessness and all of this stuff, the dignifying
thing, the thing is,
the compassion thing to do is to kill them. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's the idea. It boils down to this. But the thing is, it's not dignity. It's decence. It's they're indecent.
That's right.
That's not the same thing. But that's the real word behind it. Their use of dignity. Yes. They're indecent. They're a disgrace, you know?
Yes.
But that's not dignity. We shouldn't use dignity when we talk about this.
No, you're exactly right. We should use decency.
Decency, yeah.
We're out of time. This has been so, we'll have to talk again, because this has been so helpful. This has been, maybe we should get you and Peugeot on together or something.
Oh,
like that.
Well, that would be crazy.
After in I French. Post this, also. After, yeah, then I can't do it. Maybe you and Peugeot need to have a conversation.
But like, I was craving for, I saw my interest towards dying and like the end of life as being so much like related to everything you guys talked about. Yeah. Like it's, but I seldom hear about it. Like neither you or Jonathan Pajot or Jordan Peterson talks about death. And like, you talk about it in ways, but like not like specifically. Not
directly.
But it's so rich. It's crazy how rich it is. And like, we have the best example of Jesus on the cross, you know?
That's right.
That's the prime example of what good death is.
Yes.
This is good death, not euthanasia. Euthanasia means good death, but that's not good death. No. It's Jesus on the cross.
Yes. Well, we'll have to, we're going to have to figure out how to. So you're on the Discord server?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. So we're going to have to, maybe we'll do a Friday thing or something.
Yeah, that
and
would be
bring
cool.
And use and address this topic, because you're very right. And I really love the way this came. You're going to let me share this, aren't you?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, good. Because I hate it when I have a great conversation. And again, it's totally fine when people, there are real reasons not to share good conversations. And I completely
I could be in trouble
that.
For this too, you know?
I know. You've got skin in the game. But no, fine. this has been wonderful. I'm saving up some of these things for my vacation, so the channel isn't completely empty while I'm gone.
Yeah.
So, but I definitely want to post this, because I definitely want to see this conversation thrive.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you so much for signing up. I'm glad you got a rando slot.
So yeah,
we'll,
thank you.
We'll on the Discord server, I think we'll have to let's plan on doing something like this again. Maybe you and I, sort of like we did with Verveke, you and I can have a conversation on a Friday, and then we can let other people into the conversation, something like that.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Okay, good. All right.
Thank you, Paul. Take care.
Thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye.
God bless.